Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's guest was going to be Dr. Stuart Altman. He is caught on an airplane and a late arrival, so we're going to do things different. Instead of talking about some of the efforts that have been made in this country to develop a universal health care plan, of which Dr. Altman has been very much involved with several presidents and also involved with the development of the Obama administration's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We're going to open the phones today for questions that are directed to me and what I can do to help, as well as maybe we should get some suggestions about how well you think, as listeners, we're doing, and suggestions for programs. First, maybe it'll help to know a little bit about me and where my areas of further knowledge or better knowledge than other areas of medicine are, so that we can direct the program and the questions that you have today to an area where I feel more apt at helping. We've done this in the past, and sometimes the questions that have come in were really not questions that I felt comfortable answering. Certainly, we'll welcome any questions, and I'll do my best. But a little bit about me. I'm a pediatrician. I trained at the University of Tennessee in Memphis, Tennessee. That's not where the major medical or the undergraduate school is, but the medical units, the primary one still today is in Memphis, Tennessee. And I came up here in 1978 with the Centers for Disease Control and acted as a state epidemiologist for about 2 years. Worked for the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center for 1 year and been in private practice since that time. My areas of interest are obviously anything to do with pediatrics. I am very much aware of the psychosocial aspects of medicine and the importance of that to providing health care. I have, for a number of years, did a lot of pediatric asthma work, and that led me to a little bit more deeper knowledge of allergies and asthma, and I have a big interest in infectious disease. I also have developed particular interest in how we know what we know and providing good information, how science works in particular, and trying to educate the public on that facet of how we know what we know. Yeah, immunizations are a big concern to some people, and that's a topic with which I could give some expertise to as well. So let me remind you how you get in touch with us. If you've got questions or comments about anything, but particularly related to pediatrics and asthma, allergy, and let me say immunizations, or you have suggestions for us about how we do the program or for as we line up guests for the next year, this is how you can let us know about it. Our email address, if you don't want to come on the air, is line1. You have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. At alaskapublic.org. So the email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, will be at this phone number for the next 55 minutes or so, 550-8433. 550-8433. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. If you've got questions or comments about the topics I've suggested, you want to know a little bit more about me, or you want to make some suggestions about the program, give us a call again, 550-8433, or toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, or email us directly at line1@alaskapublic.org. We just remind listeners again, also, I have to apologize, but the guest today that was expected, Dr. Stuart Altman, was not able to make it to a telephone. He's stuck on an airplane that has been delayed, and so we're going to try to provide some healthcare information in another way, and that's with me kind of opening the phone lines and trying to do my best to answer questions or comments that you have. Please feel free to let us know what also your thoughts about line one and what we do well. And also, we're certainly interested in knowing what you think we could do better. 550-8433 is the local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. One of the really important websites that I found in preparing for the program that was going to come on today with Dr. Altman is a website called www.healthcare.gov. It's an excellent source of information about all kinds of information related to health insurance, how you can find good health insurance, how you know what to pay for health insurance, what it should cover. And there's an excellent timeline about the Accountable Care Act, which will almost now certainly proceed to continue to develop over the next year. There's a lot that needs to be done with things called healthcare exchanges, requirements and changes in the kinds of information or the programs that insurers have to provide. And if you want to really have a succinct, easy way to get a handle on what's coming down with the Accountable Care Act, www.healthcare.gov would be an excellent place to look. We have several phone calls that have come in, and we're answering those right now. As they come online, we'll go ahead and take those questions. All right, let's go ahead and take our first caller. This is Sharon. Thanks for calling, Sharon. What can we do for you?
Hello?
Yeah. What can we do for you?
Oh, yes. I had a question about asthma.
Okay.
I have reoccurring asthma. I didn't have it for a number of years.
Right.
But I can control any onset with yoga breathing. And so my question is, my son is a nurse, and he is furious that I'm not taking the preventative medicine every day. And
right,
I say,
right.
If I can control it,
right.
Why should I take the medicine?
Right. This is a wonderful, wonderful kind of question. And it's some of the information about this is very much like you're saying. But let's address this. Asthma is, let's assume the diagnosis is correct. Asthma is, to me and to many people who do this, not just one illness. It's a little bit more like diabetes now in that there are multiple probable ways that people become asthmatic, just like they may become diabetic, and so the treatments may vary. And certainly asthma by itself is variable. But one characteristic of asthma is that it's recurrent, it's periodic, it varies, and variability is a huge part of asthma, so that at early in life, it's much worse for many people. It gets better through adolescence for a large number of people, particularly males, not necessarily so much for females. And then as we age, our airways get very small again, much like, or smaller, like they do when we're a young child. And so symptoms kind of have a tendency to become more of an issue again. And what's going on in the airway is three things. The airways of the lungs are, think of like an upside-down tree with the trunk being your trachea, that air connection between the back of your throat and your lungs. And then as the airway enters the lung, it arborizes out like tree branches. And at the end of all of those branches, instead of having leaves like plant trees do, we have little air sacs. And you've got to get air to those little air sacs to get it into the blood to get it to the rest of your body. So in those airways, three things are happening that can affect the flow of the air. One, the airway can contract down, and it just is a little bit like pain. So if your arm is hurting, you have pain. If the airway lining gets injured, it contracts down with a smooth muscle. There's not a lot of pain sensation, but you have acute tightness, difficulty, feeling of difficulty taking a breath. The airway lining is full of a mucous membrane instead of a skin on the outside. Like a mucous membrane is what's inside your mouth and in your lips. And that does not make a scab or really doesn't bleed very much, but it makes a lot of mucus. So as the airway gets injured, you make more mucus. And the third thing that is happening besides constriction and that mucus production is that the airway wall is now a cylinder, and when it's injured, it swells. So the combination of those three things, the airway contracting down as it's injured and being sensitive to things like cold air or sheetrock dust or gets worse at night kind of things related to that airway will clamp down a little bit more, or mucus. And the swelling of the lining gives you variable amounts of shortness of breath, cough, and wheeze. Triggers can be allergens. They can be respiratory illnesses. They can be exercise. Now, Your question is, what about yoga and what about these preventative medications? So what we now know pretty clear is that there is a difference between subjective and objective measurements of how you're doing with many things like asthma. So many people who are taking acupuncture, or they're taking yoga, or they're taking some tea or something, they will tell us in a study that they feel as good as when they use their medications. So subjectively, they can't tell the difference often between themselves and different medications. Objectively, if we measure and can measure very accurately how well your lung function is, those medications that people take that they think make them feel good do not affect the objective measures of lung function. So this gets to that issue of kind of like a placebo effect. You may feel okay, but you're not addressing the underlying problem. As a result, you're more likely to have problems. Now, we're back to this variability, and in your particular case, I can't comment on whether or not you really would benefit from that chronic anti-inflammatory or chronic preventative medication, because I don't know enough about what your natural history is. But I'm trying to help you understand there's no question that relaxation and many things can make us feel better, but they may not be addressing the underlying problem as well as you think. Does that help you?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
You hit me in my breadbasket, Sharon.
Well, I've been thinking about that, because every time I see him, he said, "Mom, if you cough when you laugh, you still have the asthma."
I agree with him. Cough is something you shouldn't be doing, and a lot of people tell us all the time, "I don't have asthma anymore." And so the issue is, one of the things that brings out asthma the best is how much exercise you can do without getting cough or shortness of breath. And if it just takes a little laughing or a little bit of exercise to get a cough, then you're telling us you got some problem there, whether you recognize it as that or not.
Right. Well, I did the triathlon this year.
Good. So great.
Exercise is not a problem, but
good.
Coughing.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Cough.
Friends say if you go to a concert, I know you're there. Because I cough.
The preventative medications are probably generally, one, very safe, again, depends on what you're talking about, and very effective at helping prevent some of that cough. So it may be worth rethinking that.
Okay. Thank
All right.
you.
All right, Sharon.
Bye.
All right. Alice, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I live in the Matsu Valley, and I would like to see a program done on air pollution in the valley and how it affects children and the elderly. I fall in the latter category.
Yeah.
And there's three proposed coal mines that are going to be open pit strip coal mines. And we know that we get a lot of glacier dust. And I've heard, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, maybe you can clarify, the mixing of that dust, glacier dust is broken up rock, and mixing it with exposed coal dust is what causes black lung disease. So I'm very concerned about these open pit proposed coal mines with the winds we have.
Right.
If you can address that and perhaps do a program related specifically to breathing air from these open pit coal mines.
Thank you. Thank you for calling, Alice. In the a program on air pollution is not one we have done in a while, and I think it'd be very helpful. In general, I would say I'm not a great expert on the effects of environmental impact on lungs, but anybody with any lung condition will tell you for sure that particulates in the air, and that includes indoors where the primary air pollution is cigarette smoke and its particulate matter, but also outside air that has fine particulates, people with lung problems will definitely have more trouble. And it can be just natural glacial dust or fine particulate dust. I don't know the answer to the question about whether it's black lung is caused by the coal and the dust. I would have thought that it's just the coal dust by itself could do that alone. And it's well recognized as a problem for causing chronic lung disease in some. We need to keep in mind also that there are different sensitivities. Not everybody gets black lung disease to the same degree. Some people are going to have cancer that work with cigarette smoke. Some are going to have emphysema. So individual genetics to some degree define how well we can handle some of these environmental influences as well. So I think it's a great idea, and I, for some reason, was not aware that we're looking at perhaps having some open pit coal mines. So that certainly has gone down on our list of things to look at. All right. Thank you for your call. If you're still there, I can't hear you, but I hopefully I answered your question well.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to open up a cell phone or an email, and this is, I'm just going to read it right off to see where it goes. It says, love your program and forum considers of part of any strategy to decrease health care costs. Informed consumers are part of any strategy. For sure, I agree with that statement. When you have health care providers on, especially local ones who discuss treatments and procedures, would you please ask them their charges for such? I think that's a good question. I think we're one of the complaints nationally about healthcare costs in this country is the inability to get clear answers to what the costs are. One of the reasons are the multiple contracts, and sometimes within the contracts, these legal aspects of them that require are necessary for people not to discuss different contractual arrangements with people. But much more clarity about costs make a lot of sense. We often have tried to ask about what procedures cost. I think that's important. And also, I think it's important to remember that sometimes we in this country seem to jump to the conclusion if it costs more, it must be better. And that's not necessarily true. Hopefully, you listeners of the program know that that's something we do try to ferret out as well. And it says, if the providers don't know, back to this email, please point out their contribution to runaway health care costs. It also might be helpful to tell guests before they're scheduled to discuss such questions. So we'll take that all into account from that email. I appreciate that question and the comments, and I think it's those are very good ones. There's another email. I'd like to know if there's something being done to inform people about GMOs, that's genetic modified, GMFs, or genetic modified foods. This is GMOs. Hopefully that's what the person who emailed was about or was asking about, if that's true. We have done a couple of programs, although it's been a couple of years, about genetically modified foods, if that's the question. I think it's a great topic. There's a lot of misunderstanding about genetically modified foods, and I'm a believer that you have to look at everything individually and be sure and look at the safety of everything. And I also try to point out that almost all grains that we have today are genetically modified foods because they've been adapted from years and years of use before there were even any science. People learn to do certain things to grasses to make them more tolerable. So we've been changing foods genetically, whether we knew it or not, for eons. And we should all keep that in mind as well when we talk about genetically modified foods, if that's what that listener was asking about. Let's go ahead and take another phone call. Wendy, you're on line one.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for your courageous and excellent coverage of medical economics and ethics issues. I really appreciate your show on those topics.
Yeah, Wendy, thanks very much. We really appreciate that. It is you can't help but understand. I'm a believer that we have got to do something different. It's imperative, I think, for this country to decrease the percentage of costs that are going to health care if we're going to be successful. And then it doesn't even get to the point of the difficulties that individuals all are having with health care costs and how that affects their life. Nothing hurts me as much as hearing about people who've had to sell their house or go bankrupt because of some health care issue they had no part of, really.
Well, thanks. You're hitting the nail on the head. And keep going strong. Thanks.
All right. Hopefully we'll make some changes here. Thank you, Wendy. All right, I got to see one an email here that talks about immunization, so I'm going to open that up. Is how can an adult find out of their immunization status if they can't locate the medical record? It seems there should be a central database, and I haven't found one. Good point. You know, there's been a lot of resistance to centralized medical data and the confidentiality, and that is one of the unfortunate downsides of that issue. And only recently has a central database of immunizations for children been started in Alaska, and it's kind of slowly disseminating throughout the country so that physicians can get information on children. I do not know how to get your immunization status if you are older and you don't have your records, other than to say there are standard protocols, standard recommendations to catch people up and get those questions answered and get yourself well immunized if you're uncertain of where you are, and it would be based on your age. So I think almost family practice physicians, any physician, nurse practitioner could easily help you find out that information. Another potential source would also be cdc.gov, cdc.gov on the internet. If you go to that website and put in adult immunizations, you might get some idea of what might be helpful to answer that question specifically for yourself. What I would also say is there is no harm in general of giving immunizations more than they needed. Occasionally we do see people that have lost immunization records, and if we're not sure, then the general policy is to kind of start back anew, although often you don't need as many to get when you do the catch-up. And it also gives me an opportunity to encourage people to go out and think very hard about getting influenza vaccine, not only to protect themselves from an illness that can cause in some years up to maybe 20 to 30,000 excess deaths each year, but it also allows yourself to protect other people who you may come in contact with who are at greater risk than yourself from getting this illness. If you don't get the illness because of an immunization, then you can't spread it to someone else. So this is the time of year where influenza vaccines are very, very cost-effective and safe immunizations. This year, the vaccines, I think it's fair to say, it can be given to anyone except people who have ever had a very serious reaction to an immunization of influenza or who are seriously egg allergic, and that's even there are some situations where that can still be, you can still get an influenza vaccine. It's safe enough that pregnant women this year are being encouraged to get it because we know it can decrease the complications of having influenza during pregnancy, both the mother and the baby. Let me take just a second to remind listeners once again what's going on today is a special program. Our guest that was supposed to be here, Dr. Stuart Altman, health economist with Brandeis University and expert on efforts in this country to develop universal health care, could not get here to the program because of a flight delay. So what we've done is they've opened up the lines to particularly to things that I might have a little bit more expertise to. I'm a pediatrician. I've worked for the CDC and the Public Health Service when I came up here, and I have a big interest in asthma and allergy and promoting good, healthy information to the public and to try to counter healthcare myths. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is line1@alaskapublic.org. I'm sorry, that's our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And we're also encouraging you to let us know what we can do better. What are the programs you'd like to hear over the next year so we can begin to find guests that are well-educated on that topic, and also what we can do to improve your experience in getting health information. I'm going to take another email, and then we're getting close to a time when we probably need to take our mid-break. This is an email. It says it's a pediatric question. It says, what is your opinion about giving boys the human papillomavirus vaccine? He or she's got another question. So let's address that one first. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, is basically all wart viruses are the human papillomavirus. There are certain strains of HPV, number 16 and number 18, is their names that are clearly associated epidemiologically and almost causally now with cervical cancer in women. So not only do women get that virus by sexual transmitted in a sexually transmitted way, those particular viruses in certain women, those two strains in certain women, can significantly increase their risk for cervical cancer. It is not true that all women who get that infection will get it, but we know that women, once they become sexually active, very rapidly get exposed to human papillomaviruses in general, because these viruses are very ubiquitous. They're everywhere. We know the vaccine is very, very safe, and so it's been it has the potential to wipe out cervical cancer in, if not all, but many women. Now, what about boys? Initially when the vaccine came out, it had not been shown to be safe and effective in boys, and so it was not recommended. That's part of typical medical care, is we don't give treatments if we can possibly keep from it if they're not safe and effective. It's now been shown to be safe and effective, and girls do not get HPV without having sexual risks. And so now we know that boys can be safely immunized, and it's a further public health way to prevent the transmission of this virus to women, and it makes sense. An off-label reason for it is that it can prevent some genital warts, and it also, these viruses are, I think it's fair to say, increasingly being associated with head and neck cancers and other kinds of cancers, some of which are related to sexual transmission. And so boys as well may eventually be shown to have less of certain kinds of cancers by getting this vaccine as well. It is a three-dose vaccine that takes over 6 months to get fully immunized. And because you boys and girls both get exposed to the virus very quickly after they start having sexual contact, you want to start it before sexual contact is likely. And that's where some of the concerns come up. But the earlier we start it within reason, the more effective that's going to be. A second question from this listener is, what is your recommendation on how to speak to preteens about hormonal changes in sex when they refuse to discuss it? One way would be is to refer them to websites that have reliable bits of information. Again, the CDC.gov has very good information, and some, I believe, is even directed towards teens about sex and sexually transmitted diseases. They are one of the changes that appear to be coming into healthcare is that we're constantly trying to find our ways ourselves that we can interact with teens more, and they love texting and Twittering and so forth. So Twittering information texting information to children or to adolescents about appropriate websites is something that comes to my mind pretty quickly. Also, occasionally you may find some good health educational programs, both online or even in video format now, that might be reasonable to suggest that your children listen to. And I can't help but tell you, if you look back at our archives, we've had a number of programs about sexually transmitted diseases that would certainly be pertinent to adolescents that you might ask them to listen to. We recently did a program on marijuana, for example, that might be useful, or drug abuse and marijuana, and particularly alcohol abuse in adolescents, with an expert from Boston. So there's also look at our archives. So we're going to take our typical break at this particular time. We have another caller and a couple of phone calls. I appreciate everybody taking the time to call in and give us some information and ask us some questions. So we'll take this short break and be right back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today was supposed to be Dr. Stuart Altman. He's a healthcare economist at Brandeis University and he's been an expert and really at the scene of the efforts for many presidents to develop a national universal healthcare plan or program. He is unfortunately unable to make it because of some delays in airline flights today. So instead, I'm kind of opening the lines to phone calls and comments. We're asking about comments about what we do well, what we could do better, and programs you would like to hear on over the next year so we can arrange some guests. I've kind of informed people a little bit about my history. I've been a pediatrician for over 30 years. I have a special interest in asthma and allergies. I'm very interested in trying to get good information out to people and how we know good information, and that gets to understanding really what science is, and I enjoy talking about that to the public. I think it's a powerful way to understand what's real and what's not real about things that can be tested in particular. If you've got comments or questions, here's the way you get a hold of us today. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And incidentally, if you have comments about programs, you can do that. It's certainly after the program, even if you send it to line1@alaskapublic.org. We will get that information about what you like, what you don't like, and what programs you'd like to hear more about. Also, I'll just mention our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Judy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, first off, I'd like to see more programs on mental health. But my question is, in cases where I go to a clinic where I end up seeing a different doctor every time, and also seeing different specialists and then a GP, how do you get better consistency of care? Because it seems like there's often a lack of communication or they don't know you. So I'm just wondering, what can I do in that case
right. That
I'm not kind of falling between the cracks between these different doctors?
Yeah, I think you've hit one of the real problems with healthcare in the United States as it's practiced right now on the head. I think there's been a lack of communication. I can understand the needing to see multiple different providers at times with levels of expertise, but one of the things that is being driven in the country that patients may not be aware of is a movement called a medical home. And many of the private or primary care providers, family practice pediatricians and so forth, are aware of this. And it is an effort to solve some of that problem. And to be certified as a medical home, offices are going to have to document that they are providing better communication to patients, better communication and follow-up to those patients who are referred out to providers, and requiring those providers to provide good feedback back to the primary care physicians. So you're right, we need to do better at that. Part of the problem also, I would venture, is the fact that primary care physicians are often not paid for the amount of time and effort that goes into it. They're paid more for the number of patients they see, not because that's what they want to do, but because our system pays much better for procedures, and we've evolved into that that kind of format just because of the way healthcare has gone. If I was you, I would also, wherever I'm being seen, I would express my concerns about the fact that you feel like that there is not good communication even within the clinic, and see if you can do anything about it. And if not, there are offices, I can assure you, they're working very, very hard to improve the communication to and try to be as consistent about the providers that patients are seeing.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I wish I had better answers, but I think those are that's a real answer.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Let's see. Let's take another caller here. Marlena, you're on line one.
Talk a little bit more about pediatric viral skin rashes. When I grew up, I never recalled having any, you know, viral skin rashes that my mom mentioned. But it seems like every time my kids get sick or something, they one of their major symptoms is a skin rash. And
right.
The doctors say it's viral, but
right. Right. So what the heck are they talking about? Well, you probably did have some viral skin rashes. They may or may not have been recognized as that then. So one, we know a lot more about what causes many rashes in kids, and we now know that viruses will do that. But particularly if you had chickenpox and you had a rash, you had a viral skin rash. If you had measles, if you had German measles, if you had herpes, all of those are viral skin rashes. But also, we now know that Fifth's disease and a number of rashes that occur in children, usually associated with respiratory illnesses, are part and parcel of the illness, and are and we know they are caused by a particular virus. Sometimes the rashes may look the same when different viruses cause them, so they can appear to happen recurrently. One that comes to mind is hand, foot, and mouth disease that children get. They get a virus that looks, virus that causes a rash that looks a little bit like chickenpox, except it only happens on the hands and the feet. So viruses are most common illnesses that the kids are getting that are self-limited, and they infect many parts of the body, and often, particularly in younger kids, they will cause some inflammatory reaction, which originates often in the blood vessels, the tiny blood vessels near the skin, and cause various and sundry different kinds of skin rashes, per se. That is not to say that all skin rashes that happen during illnesses of kids are due to the viruses, but they we now know that that's often the case. Unfortunately or fortunately, with many of these illnesses, they're self-limited. They don't necessarily need treatment and will go away with time.
And are children with sensitive skin or with a history of eczema, are they more prone to these?
Right. Yeah, children who have a tendency towards allergies and eczema have more sensitive skin. When you think of your skin as bricks and mortar, the top layer of your skin is dead skin, and those are the bricks. And people with eczema don't have as much mortar, so they lose water by evaporation through their skin more rapidly. And that's why their skin is drier and why moisturizers done effectively can help. But as a consequence, they're also more susceptible to infection. The skin barrier is not as effective. Scratching also increases the likelihood of infection. So it's very common for children with eczema to have more significant problems with skin infections.
Well, thank you.
All right. You bet. Let's see. Let's try Bill. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks. You do this every week. You do a good job, and you seem to be a fair listener, which is what most people complain about doctors, you know that? Anyway, I was wondering about, with Obamacare being the law of the land, and we live here in Alaska, my employer is a self-insured guy, right? And so I will go to, like, a naturopath or some doctors, and they won't pay because they got through the loophole or whatever because they were self-insured that they didn't have to pay. I was wondering if you knew anything about whether that changed or not.
Yeah, I don't know what will be covered and what won't be. Part of the movement that the Accountable Care Act is looking at in cost control is how do we know that a care is the least expensive and effective, and how do we know it's even effective, and are there cheaper ways of doing things? And so all countries, not just us, are constantly having to grapple with that particular issue. And I know it's on the table. I know it's being looked at. I know it's a political hot potato. So I don't know exactly where that's going to come down. I would, however, strongly suggest that you might get an answer by going to healthcare.gov, www.healthcare.gov, and they have a little tab there about what's coming down with the Accountable Care Organization, the Accountable Care Act, over the next year, and it might have the specific answer for you there.
In my particular case, I had a pre-existing condition of Hodgkin's disease and a lifetime limit, and they both went away. And also at 65, I was going to have to go to Medicare. I don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
When my friend said, I don't like Obamacare, I go, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
But the other thing is, a previous caller mentioned mental health.
Right.
You had Fred Goodwin on a long time ago.
We did, yeah.
And that was they were interesting shows.
Right.
And he's still out there.
Yeah, no, Fred, we've had Fred Goodwin on two or three times, and
discredited. He took some money from a drug company, didn't disclose it. But
yeah,
it doesn't make his work.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
no. Yeah, exactly. Just because we all make mistakes doesn't mean everything we do. So, yeah, at least if people who listen to this program are going to notice that psychosocial aspects are at least half of everything we do. I think it's an extremely important thing and aspect. In 2 weeks, there's going to be a program on adolescent and youth mental health in particular. So,
he's not married to Doris, is he?
I don't know.
See you later, man.
I don't know.
Goodbye.
Have a good day. All right, here's an email, and it says, what allergies do you regularly see in the wintertime? Coughs and asthma attacks are kind of a strung-on sentence there. So inhalant allergens come in perennial, that is year-round ones, and seasonal ones. The seasonal ones are in the early spring are trees. And in fact, anywhere in the world, it's trees in the spring, then grasses, and then weeds. What changes is the climate. And as a result of climate change, you get different allergies of different lengths of time. We have a very short, intense birch pollen and alder pollen season in basically May, some into June. We get some grasses in July. But we're short and quick and pretty dramatic when at certain times of the year. In fact, birch pollen allergy in Fairbanks is some of the worst in the world. That doesn't answer your question. What about perennial allergens? The perennial allergens are things around year-round and particularly in the wintertime. And they're often indoor allergens. And jumping to the head of the list is animal danders up here, particularly cats. One of my favorite sayings is the most likely allergen in the people's life up here is cats. Dogs or allergens seem to be a little bit less, more subtle and not as dramatic. Dust mites are small insects that like warm, humid area. They live on animal danders, including human danders, so they're much more prevalent around beds because there's a food source, our dead skin that flakes off, and the warmth and humidity supports them. Also, you could have some mold problems in the wintertime. Molds also like warm and moist areas. So if you're hearing what I have to say and you really want to do something about it, don't have an animal and have a cool, dry indoor environment. We often complain about our environment being too dry. It is not too dry for health, and it's better for you if you have allergies. Let's go ahead and take another call. Steve, you're on line one.
Good afternoon. First of all, when I'm up here, I always listen to your show. And my suggestion is you try running it twice a week.
And then, okay.
I know it'd be tough, but it's a good show, and it's very informative.
Uh-huh.
The subject matter I'd like to see touch base with someday is psychopharmacology.
Uh-huh, okay.
Seems like the business you're in
is
basically drug-oriented now and the explosion of scripts,
right?
You know, for people, and the lack of knowledge of what all the mixture does.
Right. Yeah. No, I think psychopharmacology is a great topic, and we can get into the issues about what do we really know. There's been some questions about so much of our drug research is done by pharmaceutical companies, which raises the question of bias on reporting. And in the area of psychopharmacology, that's been a huge issue. So I think it's a very, very good suggested topic. And
I'd like to see it on your show. And like, again, if you get the funding, do it twice a week.
Just throw money at KSKA.org. support public radio.
Public radio, but yeah, I know you say it. It's I know it takes money to do this, and any of your listeners who have adult parents that are on 15 drugs a day,
yep.
Write them all down, take them to your pharmacist.
Yep. Especially when you're on that many medications, you're looking for trouble unless you're very, very careful. So.
And especially if they're from multiple doctors.
Yep. Increasingly, we are aware of what other physicians are doing because of a lot of the work that the government has done in requiring physicians and pharmacists.
Obamacare is going to help that a lot,
yeah.
With the electronic stimulus.
Right. No, we're finally moving to what banks and others have been doing for years and years and years in this country and getting more interactive. You're right.
Yeah. So, well, if you can do it, set it up, and I'll try hitting it online because I'll be leaving here shortly.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Here's an email from Margaret. She says, my son turned 17 a month ago. He is several inches shorter than his brothers were at the same age. His voice changed over a year ago, and he has little facial hair. He's convinced that he'll have a growth spurt now. He's 5'8". What would he already have had one if he was going to? Yeah. So the factors in growth are genetics to a large degree. The average man in the United States is 5'10". The average woman is 5'4". If you don't believe that, you can go to any growth chart and just take an adult or an 18-year-old boy or a 16-year-old girl and look. Now, the other thing that happens is people go into puberty at different ages, and boys and girls go into puberty at different ages. So there are individuals who are going to go into puberty late. They are often smaller based on their chronological age than they will end up. Some of those children end up getting their teeth late and losing their teeth late. And what they're telling you, or us, is that their constitutional growth will be late. They'll go into puberty late, and they will grow late. Most boys, girls go into puberty a little earlier than girls. The average girl in the United States is having their first period around 11 and a half to 12 and a half. Breast development is a year earlier and at times as low as 8 years of age can be associated with normal breast development in girls. Boys are generally a year later. They don't remember when their changes start. They're usually in the pubic areas where their changes are most obvious. And they get their growth spurt at the end of puberty relative to girls who get their growth spurt early. And that's why in junior high, so many girls look so much more mature than boys. In this particular case, to answer the question about height, it would depend on mother and father's height, some genetic situations, and knowing about mom and dad and other family members. Since his voice has changed, he has a little facial hair at 17, it sounds as if most likely he has gone into puberty at a fairly normal age, and he may not get a growth spurt later. He may or he may not. At 5'8", at 17, he still seems like he's got a reasonable potential to make it to 5'10", which is average height for men. But if mom in particular is less than 5'4", even though dad may be taller, you may get children or offspring that are kind of mixed and matched. He does not sound unusually short, and just from the information I have here. So hopefully that will answer that question. Let's go ahead and we'll take a question from Jerry. Jerry, you're on line one.
What have been the recent developments in the treatment of type 2 diabetes?
Boy, I'm going to have to tell you I don't have the best information on that, Jerry, and let me explain why. We now, as I said earlier, when talking about asthma, we know that diabetes is, particularly type 2 diabetes, is definitely different than type 1, and there are multiple ways that people can get to type 2 diabetes, and how they get there has something to do with the treatment options. But some of the people with type 2 diabetes are going to be required to have some insulin, some of the new medications that are available. If it's not too bad, weight loss and exercise is always a good idea. Exercise does help manage diabetes a little bit better. But what is happening is I don't treat much diabetes. Once the diagnosis is made nowadays, we pretty much get all diabetics to specialists who do nothing but see diabetes. And for that reason, I don't manage very many. And I can't answer your question any more thoroughly, I don't think, than I just did.
What are the new medications?
I really don't know the names of a lot of the newer medications, Jerry.
All right. Thank you.
Sorry. Yep. All right, let's see. I got an email here. It says something about a lung condition, so I opened that one. This is from Linda. It says, really enjoyed your show, and I'm a long-term listener. I had pneumonia this past winter, or past March. My x-ray, two different ones, are clear. However, I still feel discomfort. I'm able to run without getting winded. My left lung has never been the same. I'm in good health, exercise daily. Would this mild discomfort be normal? My first thought is if the x-ray is normal and you're progressively not getting worse, particularly with shortness of breath or cough, then it's probably okay. One of the real important things for any listener to pay attention to is worsening symptoms over time, or chronic symptoms that are not getting better over time are indications of significant problems. Many people who do have pneumonia do not have long-term sequelae that are significant. Some might, however, depending on what kind of pneumonia they had and whether they had any underlying problems before the pneumonia. So I think the normal chest x-ray, the ability to run without being winded, Linda, is very good. If it just doesn't feel the same on the left side and it's not progressing, it's probably okay to not worry too much about that. However, if it is causing progressive problems, I'd go back to the provider that was seeing you and see if more treatment more investigation needs to be done. Sometimes a plain chest x-ray does not give us as much information as other kinds of testing might. All right, let's go to another question here. This question comes from Sue Ellen. It says, what will happen in Alaska since the governor's turned down funds to set up the health exchange? It's my understanding the exchanges will be operated at a federal level, but I'm not sure how that'll look. So one of the things that's required under the Accountable Care Organization, and here I am not an expert on this, is that but all states have to have some exchanges. They had the opportunity either to set them up themselves or with the help or with the direction of the federal government. And I think you're right that Governor Parnell has elected not to have the exchanges set up. So the feds will come in and do it. In federal exchanges, are insurances that are approved, and that's where people will go to shop for their insurance. These plans have to meet certain requirements, is my understanding as well. And the ways they are underwritten is also controlled to some degree. All of this has to be done within the next year. It may sound easy to do, but a lot of rules have to be done, and there needs to be a heck of a lot of work before these exchanges roll out, although I think they're supposed to be rolled out by 2014. So that's I can't answer exactly what's going to happen here. And I'm not sure I understand all the repercussions of the fact that Governor Parnell has elected not to do that. My gestalt is that may not have been best for all of us. But again, that's just one of some of the stuff I've been hearing about how this program's going to roll out. I'm not sure if you have had a program on stem cell advancements in healthcare, but this would be an interesting topic. Are stem cell treatments approved and being used for treatment in the U.S. at any time versus Europe and Canada? And this is from the same writer, Sue Ellen. And yeah, we are having some stem cell work being done. I don't think that there's much difference here than versus other countries. They need to be shown to be safe and effective. There is a lot on the internet about stem cells and a lot of quackery, a lot of getting your money about with the word stem cells showing up on it. It is an extremely complex and expensive proposition. I think there are unscrupulous people making you think that the stem cell is, in a word, on their advertisement on the internet, makes you think you're going to get something that's really stem cells or that have been shown to be safe and effective when that's not the case. So thinking about stem cells, we want to be very, very careful about what you're really getting. And it would make a great program and has gone down on my list of things to talk about. Let me give my, ooh, golly, it's already 5 minutes till. This has been a fast program. I looked up very quickly to give people my phone number. I think we'll hold off on that because we've only got a couple of minutes. I've got a couple more phone calls. But I appreciate the questions that people did call in about. Here's a question that looks like it has to do with health, climate change. This is from Heidi. It says, I've been hearing a lot about increased health problems worldwide caused by climate change. What effects will the health of Alaskans you anticipate or have you already seen related to health climate change? There's already been significant some changes that seem to be related. There's been certainly an increased number of bee stings, and particularly in Fairbanks, and even excessive deaths due to anaphylaxis to bee stings, which seems to be directly related to climate changing over time. And so, as we mentioned earlier, when climates do change, everything changes as a result. We may see more allergies. We may see certain kinds of infections in particular more. There's been arguments about some of the viral encephalitis infections in the lower 48 may also be related to some of the warming trends that make mosquito more ability to be more infectious or to live longer is one of the problems. So there will be changes. There'll be good changes and there'll be bad changes. How to sum all that up? I'm not well enough to good enough to be able to tell you. We're coming up close to the end of the program, and I think what I'm going to do is end up now, although there are a number of emails that I've not been able to address, and I appreciate all those efforts, and any of them that have suggestions for programs we'll take very, very seriously and look at. Next week, our program will be, I think, very, very interesting as well, and I found a quote that kind of gets us into the mood. Franklin Roosevelt has stated that we cannot always build the future for our youth, but we can build our youth for the future. And Monday's guest will be Deborah Williams, Director of Anchorage Youth and Development Coalition, and Sarah Sledge, who's the Director of Community Action with United Way of Anchorage. And they are both working to do just that, to develop our youth for the future. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, November 19th, from 2 to 3 p.m. And remember, the program repeats each Monday at 7 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA. And so just because we have just about a minute left, I also want to remind people again, if you send suggestions to us about programs or topics or guests, line1@alaskapublic.org will get us that information and we will take a look at it. Also, don't hold back. If you think we're doing something particularly well, we want to keep doing it. And if you think we need to do something better, let us know that. We'll take it all into consideration to try to make this hour each Monday a better program for you guys. All right. Let me remind everybody again that my cohort in crime here is Kristen Spack. She's usually our web editor. She is our web editor and also helps me on phone calls and answering emails and shortening them so I can read them pretty quickly. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.